being forms of taxation, and then fear and honor being two forms of respect. So whether there is a progression from one to the second, and then within that, but it's hard to see that necessarily. So I just see two parallels within two different categories that need to be addressed. One on the financial side, very practical. The other is even in the spirit in which we deal with our authorities, that how we speak of them, how we treat them. So. For a conscience. Yeah. So there's two reasons given throughout this passage. One is because they're going to administer punishment from God upon us through disobedience, and the other one is because we know that God has placed them in authority, and to defy them is to go against God. So, all right, we're just kind of wrapping up here. The conclusions with what we looked at last time, and I don't know, I kind of feel impressed to try to bring some of this to a head, because we could keep on going for a long time, and so I started into studying Acts, and I thought, you know what, this is going to get kind of boring for people, week after week, hitting some of these things, so we'll see if we can bring some summary to it, but I'll just finish just giving some observations over the study in 1 and 2 Samuel. And we saw last time that there were lots of examples of obedience to the right kind of authority. That's when that's seen, you've got a good authority placed there by God, and someone's submitting themselves underneath that. That is the arrangement that glorifies God. He wants that. But there are times when there were situations where a rightful authority was stepping out of bounds, and disobedience was required. And there was even someone who was a rightful authority but giving a wrong command, and several instances of that were people who stepped up and obeyed those commands really were wicked men who were doing those things. We saw how that there were examples of disobedience, and some of those were okay. It was all right. Other places, it was not okay. And it's interesting, one of them that sticks out to me is Jonathan. He disobeys, and he does it even unknowingly. When his father said, "Let no one eat anything during this battle," he makes an oath before the Lord. And he disobeys that, and it's clear from the passage that that oath was showing something that was wrong in Saul's heart. He was becoming proud, and his focus was upon himself in that arena and what he said. But they didn't, I forget exactly what happened. The Lord didn't answer them, I think it was. They tried to request to find out, and God wouldn't even answer Saul. And he said, somebody sinned. And so let's find out. And they cast lots. So the lot's in the hand of the Lord. The Lord's going to identify who did the sinning. And it wasn't the people, it was Saul and his house. And they got Saul and Jonathan. And it was like, there are only two of us, and they cast lots, and it was Jonathan. So he had broken the oath, even unknowingly, that his father had set, and God says, I'm not answering you until you get this address. Now, Saul's response to that, I think, showed his hardness of heart. He wasn't trying to honor the Lord in killing Jonathan, and the people ultimately saved him. And some of those things are not just, I'm not trying to just come up with that on my head, but you have to see the parallel within the narrative of the text. Saul himself was the one who was acknowledged as the king just several chapters earlier, and several people said they were called sons of Belial. They didn't want to submit to him, and the people said, "Who?" And they said, they cast him off. There's a big victory in the next chapter, and they say, "Let's bring forth those people who didn't want to submit to Saul and kill them right here." And Saul said, "This is a day of great deliverance from the Lord. No one should be killed on this day." So he, in a parallel situation, expresses the truth that he should have had in this situation. So I think when you see the narratives and how God puts them together, I think that it really helps us interpret and see that God still takes disobedience seriously. And even when it's not, even if it's unknown in terms of in the oath that's made before God. So anyway, I'll leave that there. I want to just two areas of left in terms of the study is I went through and noted all the places where someone underneath someone else was challenging their authority. And actually, as there were so many of them, I thought, you know, this might be part of a theme in this book, because there's a lot here. The sons of Eli were wicked, and they were taking the best of the meat for themselves. And there was a certain way they were supposed to do it. And the people were saying, hey, what you're doing isn't right. And they said, you're going to let us do it, or we're going to come in and take it by force. And so they're like, But they verbally spoke up against the priests who are not following God's law. We see that people refused to let Saul kill Jonathan, and they gave a response back to Saul and said, this is the reason why he has wrought deliverance. David objects to Saul, asking him to put on his armor, and he says, I have not proved these. And so he gives a reason why he believes he shouldn't do it, what he's being asked by his authority, and he goes forward, and I think probably in some ways Saul relented in that. Jonathan confronts Saul multiple times in the book. He's saying, Dad, why are you trying to kill David? And even goes to the part in the second time and asks him, says, what evil has he done? He's trying to reason with his father and saying, what you're doing is not right. You don't have any justification for this. David reasons with Saul, especially after the first encounter when he comes out of the cave and he bows down and he calls him my father and he begins to reason with him saying, why are you doing this? Why are you coming after a flea, a little bird running in the wilderness? I'm nothing. I'm a nobody. Why? And he said, but I'm true and honored. I had the opportunity to kill you. I'm faithful to you. And Saul ultimately says, I'm doing wrong. I'm doing sin. And he confronts him the second time. There's not as much a challenge as much as, but Saul again recognizes that he did wrong. Interestingly enough, Abigail comes to David and petitions him and says, oh, what's your opinion? Is not good. It's not going to honor the Lord. You're going to have grief. You're going to have regret later. And so she David. David confronts, oh, I got that there. Abner challenges Ishbosheth. Now, this isn't really a great aspect where Ishbosheth challenges him for an inappropriate relationship with a concubine, and Abner talks back to him, and he was his general, his king. Nathan confronts David about his sin with Bathsheba. Obviously, that's the Lord speaking to David, but Nathan is underneath the king as a prophet, and he was summoned to go confront him. Joab confronts David over Solomon's abandonment, but this is before his treachery. Then after his treachery, Joab confronts David again about his weeping for Solomon and causing everyone else to run away and to feel ashamed that they won the victory and beat Solomon. And then Joab, at the end of 2 Samuel, protests against the census of the King David, which was a wicked census, and God actually judged them for it, but Joab is seen making a protest before that ever takes place. And so I think we see through this that it's certainly right and appropriate in most cases in this book to challenge authority when they are doing what's wrong, to go to them, and to bring up to, on the basis of principle and to challenge a king, to challenge an authority, acknowledges something, does it not? That you are appealing to a standard that is higher than they are, right? That's acknowledging that you're the king in Israel, and any king is still underneath the law of God. And therefore, they can be approached and said, this isn't right. This is wrong because you are violating what you are underneath. And I think that's an important acknowledgement. And then we see throughout the book that God deals with improper authority. When authority goes wrong, God fixes it. And that'll encourage us. When God killed Hophni and Phinehas. Those were wicked men. They were abusing their authority. And God says that when they were confronted, they did not listen. Why? Because God's purpose was to slay them. He wasn't allowing them repentance. He said, you guys have gone far enough. You're going to hear the warning, but you're not going to listen. You're going to die. There's an aspect of, I put this down. I think it doesn't exactly fit, but Dagon falls before the Ark of the Covenant. There is a supreme authority. and every other pretense to authority must fall down before him. And that's an important aspect here. David's understanding and the reason why he didn't kill Saul was because he knew that God would deal with him. He said he's going to fall some other way, but it will not be by my hand. And David expresses great faith in the Lord on two occasions in that regard. And then Saul ultimately was punished. He went to see the witch of Endor, and he was punished because he did not obey the law of God. And it's clear that his life was seen, you know, with that's a huge theme in terms of what's the, one of the main verses, to obey is better than sacrifice, you know, rebellion. Witchcraft is as the sin of rebellion, which is interesting because that's where that he was confronted. He was compared with witchcraft, and at the end, he goes to a witch, and God tells him, because you disobeyed me way back then, I'm taking the kingdom from you, and he and his sons were killed. And so God deals with, you can look at David, his sin. You have caused the enemies of God to blaspheme, and he deals with him. And he commits the sin of the senses. He deals with them. And it's interesting that in that passage, God says that because the people of Israel were sinning, God raised up David and allowed Satan to tempt him and allowed David to sin so that when the punishment fell, it fell on him and the people. So sometimes God allows rulers to sin to punish the people of the rulers. And so that's a part of a way God works. So we could go on and on. We could look at examples in 1 and 2 Kings. We could look at Ezra. Ezra is very fascinating to me because everything that they were doing was underneath a foreign king. They were underneath the authority of the the Persian Empire. And what's very interesting was that there are letters that said, God says you can go back, Cyrus says you can build. Amazing. God working through unbelieving. Maybe Cyrus was saved. I'm not sure. There's indications that he wasn't from history necessarily because he was certainly into idolatry and things that we know from other aspects. But statements he makes here at least seem to give, in the scripture, give pretense, not pretense, give honor to the Lord in what he says. He is the God. Send them back. I want them to build that temple and offer sacrifice for me and my sons. So this is really great. But then some of the, you know, Sanballat and Tobiah, and I don't think those were there in Ezra, those were Nehemiah, but some guys like them in Ezra, they write some letters back to the king, and the king says, wait a second, Jerusalem has been a rebellious city, they're going to rebel against again. So he writes back and says, stop building. And so they stopped. Okay, every point they're obeying, they've got a decree to build, now they've got a decree not to build. God comes to them through Haggai and Zechariah, and he says, get your tool belt back on, go start building. Before they ever had, now they wrote a letter of petition, and they challenged their authority. They went through the avenues that they could to honor that authority, but they started building, and they started disobeying the command. And God told them to do it. And they were honoring the Lord by putting him first, even in the face of jeopardizing their lives. And you know how the story goes. The king writes back and says, I have looked. There was an edict like this, and all these people are trying to stop you. They've got to help you. And they start funding the project, and God does a wonderful thing. So God brings and realigns and shapes. We could look at Daniel and his disobedience of a king's command simply to pray. Now, of course, that's at the... But he could have prayed in his heart. He didn't have to defy the king, but he did. I think he had to. I think it was the right thing to do. You can look at Mordecai. Now, he's a controversial guy because he would not bow down to Haman. You say, was it wrong for men, Jews, to bow down to other men? We just talked about David bowing down to Saul, did we not? He comes out of the king and bows himself down. Did not Jacob bow down to his brother 7 times? They could bow down to men and showing reverence, but something about this bowing down to Haman was against his principles. He understood this was tantamount to worship in some way. And so Haman looked at it and said, I cannot do that because I'm a Jew. It's because of the law of my God. Some people fault him for that. I don't. Because the book of Esther is all about Mordecai being raised to the place of exaltation. So clearly, Haman did what was right, wrong, Mordecai was doing what was right, and God blesses him and brings him down his place. So it's pretty clear. So there's an element there of disobedience again to the king's command. He defied the king's command to have everyone bow down to Haman. He would not do it on principle's sake. So I think we have to come into this area of, I'm going to come back to, I did study this week on Acts, and that's when I kind of realized I'm going to bring some things out of it, but I think we'll see how much time we got. Okay. Let's just address real quickly here, what about constitutional issues? Constitutional issues here in America, and I don't know if we can do this really quick or not, but that has the idea of, it's really questioning who is the legitimate authority. Because we can ask, it is possible for someone to use power, and a leader can set himself up above the government. And this has definitely been something that has taken place throughout history. We can look back and say the English Puritan movement fought a civil war in England over this very issue. Who has the authority? Is it the king or is it Parliament? So there, we're taking it outside of America and putting it within their aspect of thing. And so the king viewed himself as an absolute ruler. He believed in the divine right of kings, which meant that if I said it, then that's God's will for you. You know, and so there is an element that, you know, sometimes I say that about kings. Sometimes pastors feel that way. You know, God's hands upon me. Therefore, if I said it, that has to be right. That has to be good. You've got to follow it. And I think that goes too far. I think you understand that goes too far. I think it goes too far for a king to say that just as much too. Interestingly enough, those men were in covenant theology. They believed that the Old Testament examples could be imitated. They believed that in terms of like Josiah, or Joash, I think Joash may be a better example, where they had Athaliah was ruling. The people of the land threw off the leader, killed the queen, and that's why if we went into 1 Kings, we'd have to look at Jehu's rebellion, and you know, we'd look at all these different ones. And there are times when there were all kinds of examples where conspirators rose up and killed kings, and they were not good because they were slain, they were killed. God makes a point of noting that. That wasn't a good idea. This was a bad king. These people killed him. That wasn't good. You know, you could do that in the book of Esther. Two men tried to kill Ahasuerus, and they were slain. And that was part of the reason of Mordecai being exalted, because he understood that plot. He didn't say, mum's the word. You know, he actually lived for the benefit of his foreign dominating power and let the king know that this was coming. Anyway, interesting, all these type of things. So Oliver Cromwell rose to power, and they decapitated, if I remember right, the king. They cut off his head. Is it King Charles, I think, maybe? I'm trying to think, yeah. Second, yeah, okay. They said, this issue is so important. What happened was King Charles II had actually hired people from Ireland, and I don't know if it was Scottish or Irish or whatever, to come over as mercenaries and fight against his own people. And they felt like that was a breaking, you're our king, and you're hiring foreign people to come into our land and fight us. That you're treating us as if we're not your people. You're not submitting to the parliament, and you're not submitting to the law. And so therefore, they felt serious enough about that, and they had him killed. And so they instituted an application of God's law upon the land. So that's probably the closest that we've come to reinstatement outside of maybe some places in the New World, where they were saying if it's wrong in the Bible, we're going to apply it as it's wrong here in England. And so they, in some of this, you know, I'm not here to talk about what's the best government or not, but it did prove to them, and a lot of people who came out of that, American Revolution came out of that, and there was kind of this understanding that they saw what went wrong in that situation, because there was no liberty of conscience. And so it was one viewpoint on the Bible and the interpretation thereof. And if you were against that, you were against the state. And so therefore, there was a lot of people who were conscientious dissenters who were persecuted, not because they were doing something against the moral law of God, but because they didn't follow the religious perspective of Puritanism. There was kind of came out of that the idea of seeing a need for a separation between government and the church. Not, but we're talking about keeping the church from being influencing the state, but keeping the state from controlling the churches. All right, make that clear. So there was also a civil war in Scotland over this. And Rutherford wrote the books Rex Lex, which means the king is underneath the law. And this was a very controversial statement to say the king must submit to the law of God. He must submit to the law of the land. He cannot do whatever he wants to do. And if he violates those things and he breaks the law of the land, then he should be held accountable through the people of the land. And he argues against the tyranny of monarchs. His books were burned. He was arrested and he died in prison before he could be sentenced. There's an aspect to which our Revolutionary War raised the same question. Who has the rightful authority? And England said, we do. We're the mother state. You have to submit. You should submit to our taxation. And they felt like that they were more and more treated as if they were a vassal rather than actually Englishmen. And interestingly enough, England would hire foreign mercenaries to come over and fight its battle against the and so clearly those that they saw parallels with things that were going on before. So there's kind of a movement that said the American Revolution came out of the spirit of what it means to be an Englishman, understanding that the king is underneath the law and that he has made a covenant with the people. And if he violates his agreement, his covenant, it is the right of the people to rebel against that government and to overthrow it. And then you can ask the question, was it right to secede from the Union? You know, what would you have done in that day in terms of, you know, you can argue the principles of the South and the North and those type of things. And, of course, slavery gets involved in all that, too. And so it kind of raises questions. And I say we're kind of come to a situation where we have, I think, it's not new. We're living under 100 years of American overreach when it comes to maybe 120. When you talk about progressivism in the United States, if you're familiar with that element and what the goal was to completely change, our government as a constitution was set up so that the power would be in the representative branch, because the power of our government is set up so that the government is not in charge, the people are in charge. We are the power, and therefore that's what they want to do. They want to actually separate the power from the people who are actually ruling. And the way that they felt like that would be done the best is if you make the people who are the most connected to the people, which would be in the legislative branch, the representatives, that they would have the shortest term limits. They'd have to be coming back, running for re-election on a regular basis, and that the people's voice would be able to govern. And yet it's set up as not as a democracy, but as a republic. And so you understand that. We've got three branches of government. I'm sure most of you are very, very well versed of all these things. And we have legislative, and we have the judicial, and we have the executive branch. Well, through the progressive movement in our country, it has moved away to diminish the power of the legislative branch. And so what happens is Congress doesn't write a law. They just write a law that says we want clean air. But they don't specify what that means, and then they say the EPA, they tell us what clean air is and how we're supposed to get it. And so what you have is, underneath the executive branch, you have big, large groups that are experts who are running and basically making the policies. And what happens is, within those governments, within those branches, they are the legislative, they are the judicial, and they are the executive. You have a problem with the EPA, guess who you get to appeal to? The EPA. And the EPA will judge whether you're in compliance with the legislation that they wrote, and they get to give you the punishment. And so what's taken place is, and pretty much all the big organizations in terms of government have begun to function this way. And this has been a progressive plan that has been instituted for over 120 years. Well, we're seeing the fruit of that taking place in our country. And there's an aspect that says, how did we get here? How do you get back? What is the best? And we have the power as the people to determine our own form of government. But be quite honest with you, how much power do we have as individual citizens? I mean, we can try to vote, and we can do what we can. We can run for office. But there's an element to which, when you get into politics, there are many things at work to keep honest people at bay and to keep them out of the system. It is, in some ways, I'm not trying to sound like it's, for anybody that still feels like hope, and I feel like it doesn't matter whether there's hope or not, we ought to do what's right regardless. So I don't want to discourage someone, but I think a realistic viewpoint of where we're at in our country is, we're not going back to 1776. All right, I don't think that we're going back to the way, there's an aspect of, we look at it in terms of this is the power to be, and yet at the same time, what do you do when someone just rises up and says, well, I've got this authority and I'm going to make sure this happens, and they decree something as if they're a king when there's checks and balances. So I think, let's just look over some principles. Well, I'm going to summarize all of this in 10 minutes. So. I think that there ought to be times when we give up our rights as American citizens and give up we don't fight certain battles because of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And part of that is in Matthew chapter 17, we kind of looked at that story, but they came to Peter and asked him, does your master pay tribute? And he says, yes, we do. We do pay tribute. And he goes to him and says, Simon, who do the kings of the earth exact tribute from? And he says, of their children or strangers? And he says, if you say I have to pay tribute, then you're denying that I am the child of the Father. I am the son of this temple. I don't have to pay taxes. To pay taxes would seem, in some ways, to deny who he is. So he's challenging Peter on this regard, but he does go on in verse 27, says, Matthew 17, notwithstanding, lest we should offend them, go thou to the sea, cast a hook, and take up a fish. And so I think for us as believers, as a church, our overarching authority has got to be the gospel of Jesus Christ. When I was doing my study in Acts, what I felt like was the impulse was that the church has authority because Jesus Christ commanded them. You can look at the beginning of Acts, and it was the Holy Spirit commanding, the Lord commanding, the angel of the Lord commanding, and it was the apostles who were going around, and they were speaking with authority. When the evil rulers came to them and said, you, and three times they are confronted in Acts, it's not just a one-time occurrence, it's three times they are told and arrested not to speak in Jesus' name. Do not be representatives of him. And they says, you'll have to judge, but we're going to obey God rather than men. So I think when we look at all these things, you can see the Apostle Paul, there are occasions when he uses his Roman citizenship, and there are occasions when he doesn't use his Roman citizenship and then later uses it. There are times when he tells the rulers what they're supposed to do, and there's other times when he is very humble, beseeching Roman centurion and taking that element. I think to answer, to sum up in some of these things, our heart has to be acknowledging who God is as the ultimate authority. Jesus Christ is on a throne. He commands us. We must obey him. That spirit, when you have that spirit, you will not have a cavalier response, a grumbling, irritated, response towards our leaders. We will not be rebels. Because God is the sovereign head. He has put them here, and we are going to work with the dealings in which God has worked it out. He's in control, and I must submit. So that it's the authority of God that makes us is the most powerful, compelling argument for submission to government leaders. But it's also God's authority is the most compelling argument for why we must disobey them. If it's against God's word and his principle, and it's not something we just kind of extrapolate out, but it's a conviction. It's something that we truly believe is against God, that we ought to stand up and we ought to do what's right. You know, and so that brings us to, we can go back to historical situations. I'll say this, I am not here prepared to say that what the English did in the 1600s and what the Americans did in the 1700s and what even some people in the South did in the 1800s, that those things were wrong. You say, well, what about Romans 13? Yes, Romans 13 is there, but so is a lot of other passages of Scripture. And I would say, you know what? I bet you in every one of those situations, there were people who were doing it for wrong reasons. I bet you there was people who weren't submitting to God and they were filled with selfishness. But I don't believe that there's an aspect that it says that I can sit here and say, oh yeah, the Revolutionary War, that's completely wrong. I could have never done that. Well, what would you have done in 1700 when you're living in Massachusetts and you say, I'm a loyalist. This is the current government. I've got to submit to England. Massachusetts rebels. They sign they sign the Declaration of Independence. And now your local authority says you're against England. Now you say, oh, now the power that be says I've got to submit to this. Now I'm taking up arms to kill the British. You say, someone comes in your house and they say, now I'm the king. You're going to obey. Okay? You've got to make a determination. Is that person and what they're doing, is that the rightful authority? You've got to make that determination, and you have to do it before God. And I believe that God gives wisdom to believers in the moment. He doesn't give you a plane ticket to a destination he never asked you to go. He will give you the wisdom you need and I need to respond to the situation as it arises. And I think there's elements to which, you know, we can go back and we can look at how our authority, I think, you know, I don't mean to bring up old wounds or other things like that, but our government clearly overstepped itself when it came to COVID-19. They recognized that the basis on which that was done was not legitimate. And the power that they seized during that time was not legitimate. And through the courts have acknowledged that years later. And churches that defied some of those things. And the way our government works is, if someone passes a law that you disagree with, part of the duty of how a citizen can respond to that is just disobey the law. If you see that as an unconstitutional law, disobey the law, face the consequences of it, and then take it to court. That is the means that our government in America has established for it to happen. And if you get to court and you say, well, I'm suing the state of Kansas for their closure of churches, the judge is going to ask and say, can you show me how they hurt you? What are the damages that they cause? You say, there is no damages. There's no case. All right, what are your damages? Well, I disobeyed the law, and they fined me $100,000. Here's my damages. Okay, now we've got a case, and they'll take it up. So part of the way that a believer can operate, I think you can go down that road of respectful civil disobedience against what you believe is an unlawful command and take it through the judicial system. That doesn't mean you're going to get the right verdict either. Because the judicial system here, I mean, there's any judicial system, as you look at the Bible, things can go awry and things can be done wrong. I would say what I have learned and come out of it, I would say our church is not going to shut down because of another medical mandate. Doesn't mean that everybody should come, but I believe in my heart that as the authority comes from God and from Jesus Christ, the state does not have the authority to tell a church to stop meeting. And I believe they overstep their bounds, and I would, you know, in a respectful way, in a way that's not you know, and it means that you go through it in a way that's trying to be careful. It doesn't mean that you're going to try to show them that we're not trying to defy you, but we are going to obey the Lord. And so that's something that coming out of all that is a way. Anyway, look at the time. One last thing. Maybe we can bring up for questions next time. I don't know. We'll see in terms of if people would like to do that or not. But I just want to remind us that throughout history, the church has been persecuted by governments, and God has dealt with them. Calvin's Institute was written to defend Christianity at a time of great persecution. They said that the streets of Paris ran with blood. 30,000 Protestants were killed. And yet Charles IX died at the age of 24. He died in such a manner that blood began to run out of every opening in his body. In a very disgusting and painful death that people could not help but see the way that he died with the persecution that he instituted. God dealt with him. You know, maybe you've seen the movie Flame in the Wind with Ridley and Latimer. They were burnt at the stake for their stand against even things that we might say, whoa, is that really that important? But for their conscience, they were burned to the stake in England. And the government official who prosecuted them and ultimately had them killed was, they said that he received a terrible inflammation inside of his body, that he began to swell from the inside out, and his tongue ultimately hung from his mouth, swollen. And he said, "I have sinned like Peter, but I have not wept like him." He knew that he was killing the God's people. Puritans were put out of their pulpits, 2,000 of them at one time, and within several years, the bubonic plague came upon England. And in London, 100,000 people died, and a fire came out the next year and burnt 90 of the 97 churches in London. So ultimately, I hope that I've communicated the spirit of Romans 13 as we've gone through this, and I'd be glad to. We've had many discussions. I think they'd be good to have some. I hate to open up questions because I'm not a guru. I can't answer every situation. I really do want to put it upon you to recognize that I have a responsibility for God to make sure that I'm in submission to God. I recognize His authority. I'm in submitting to my government. That's one of the ways that I demonstrate in a very practical way. I am not a rebel. I'm not constantly disobeying my authority. But at the same time, I have a boldness that for Jesus Christ, I would disobey if I had to, because I love Him more than I love myself. And may God help us to have that kind of spirit towards our government. So I'll open up for questions next time. And if you've got one, write one down or something like that. And we'll see if maybe we can have a live discussion, hopefully not split the church, but love each other, maybe lovingly disagree. God gives us that perspective to help us, so that's a good thing. All right, you're dismissed for church.